The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
And I suspect then what he was talking about to some degree was what he was saying was we had a church that was filled with EO evangelists. Now, you don't grow churches with EO evangelism. You really don't. All you do is add members. You get them from there and put them over here. It's sort of a simple question of taking apples out of one box and putting them into another box. Your box may get filled, but that box gets smaller so that nothing is really added. You're just shifting boxes. Now, I think there's a lot of truth there. E1 evangelism would be called monocultural evangelism. Focuses on the cultural group in which the church is planted, and specifically on people who do not call themselves Christians. So it's a little different from EO. You're working with people who are very genuine outsiders, as it were. Ralph's criticism of the Lausanne Congress, if I've got him right, was that it put a great deal of emphasis on EO and E1 evangelism. Putting it another way. Now, the problem with this, with all of this, is that three-fourths of the non-Christians in the world cannot be reached through EO or E1 evangelists. And that's just simply the facts of life. Why? Because they aren't there. So that would be true, and this is Ralph's point, even if we multiply 100% or 500% or 8,000% the number of EO or E1 evangelists. Taiwan is a very good example. The vast majority of the people on the island are native Taiwanese, or what technically, culturally, you would call Minnan Chinese, M-I-N-N-A-N. They've been on the island for several hundred years. They came also as immigrants from the mainland, from the Fujian province of China, and most of them speak a particular dialect of the Fujian province. So they came there then, and they speak this particular, settled on the island, and use this particular language. It's grammatically and phonetically and phonetically quite distinct from the mainland or Mandarin dialect. Now, approximately 80% of the people living on Taiwan use that language and form that culture. After 1949, a flood of mainlanders came to Taiwan when Mao took over the mainland. And there was a tremendous wave of mass migrations to Taiwan. The people who came, almost all, spoke the Mandarin dialect. And they functioned in the Mandarin culture. They were a different ethnos. About 10% of Taiwan is mainlander population. 80% native Taiwanese, 10% mainlander, and the remaining 10% of the population of Taiwan is broken up not since the normalization statement by Carter in December. There are no American troops or anybody on the island. But the remaining 10% is broken up into Aboriginal peoples, mostly on the eastern coast of Taiwan, the mountains. There's about roughly 100,000 of these, and Hakka people. There are about 1 million Hakka on the island. Now, that just gives you a general picture. If a mainlander wins a mainlander to Christ, what would you call that? E1 evangelism. Right.
Depends on the mainlander he wins. If he's a member of the choir, he would be EO evangelist.
Righto. Very good. How about the Hakka? The Hakka, there are today almost no churches among the Hakka. And of the over 600 missionaries on the island, there are only three or four working with the Hakka, working with 1 million people. It is impossible then to reach the Hakka people through EO or E1 evangelism. It's impossible. There is virtually no church among the Hakka. I think I know one or two congregations among a million people.
Mm.
Now, how are you going to reach a million people with E1 evangelism? Can't be done. This numerically, statistically, it's impossible. They are, in Ralph's language, they are unincorporatable. There are no churches that exist virtually within the Hakka that they can be brought into. So to evangelize the Hakka, you must have E2 or E3 evangelists. Now, E2 evangelism focuses on evangelizing culturally near neighbors. The E2 evangelist crosses cultural boundaries, but cultural boundaries that are not profoundly, very radically distinct. He does cross the boundary. On the other hand, an E3. E3 aims at winning people to Christ who are separated by sharp cultural boundaries. E2 evangelism would be the equivalent of sending a missionary from the United States to do evangelistic work among non-Christians in Canada. That would be E2 evangelism. As culturally, there is a cultural difference, but it is not that radical a difference. Or vice versa, a church in Canada sending an evangelist to do evangelistic work in the United States. In Taiwan, an E2 evangelist would be somebody who goes from the mainlander people to evangelize the Hakka. They are distinct cultures, but yet there are also large similarities. So they're culturally near neighbors. On the other hand, E3 evangelism in Taiwan would be a mainlander going to evangelize the mountain people, the Aborigines. And those are sharp cultural differences. So, for example, today the history of that is fascinating. Among the Tayal peoples, one of the largest Aboriginal groups, and now the percentage of Christians among the Tayals is over 80%.
Hmm.
Whereas the total Christian population for the entire island is only 3%. Now, if you look at Taiwan, like we've been doing, you know, by country, you say, how do we reach Taiwan? Well, how many people in Taiwan are Christians? 3%. You know, the job's impossible. Then you start poking around. You say, now wait a minute, way up there in the mountains there's a group called the Tayals. And look at that, over 80% Christian. What's going on here anyway? They're just culturally and ethnically very distinct people. And you can begin to see the dangers then in looking at too big a picture and not being able to see people in there. Now, the difference between these categories is not geographical but cultural. And I think that's important. E1 evangelism crosses only one barrier, the frontier between the church and the world. E2 evangelism adds a second frontier. It crosses the barrier where there is some significant but not monumental difference of language or culture or practice. And then E3 involves even greater cultural differences. For example, a Jew. In the book of Acts, Philip, sent by the Spirit to Samaria to evangelize, would be a case of E3. Because, they're linguistically, he's not talking about even language either. Because I think Philip, there was a common language then in the Greek. But there was a radical difference between the Samaritans and the Jews. The Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans and vice versa. That's why it was such a shock in the Gospels, you know, when Jesus went to a Samaritan woman at the well. How is it that you, being a Jew, you know, ask me, a Samaritan, for a drink? The Lord said, I think sensitive to that, and also in terms of redemption history, told his disciples never to go to the Samaritans to preach the gospel. He said, go not in the way of the Samaritans, don't preach to the Gentiles, only the lost sheep of Israel. Anyway, that would be an example of E3 in the Bible.
Could I just ask a question? Between E2 and E3, the barriers are exactly the same, but they're just more pronounced.
Yeah, right, right.
So, using Winder's example, an E2 evangelist would be an American going to evangelize in Mexico, and he'd need to pick up a bit of Spanish.
Yeah.
Whereas 80% of the words are shared.
Right.
But an E3 evangelism would be that same man in Mexico dealing with a tribe of Indians.
Right, right, right. That would be E3, right.
So is it the job of Mark to decide what kind of evangelism he is?
That's part, right, right, and it's part. I think part of it. That's why Mabel, in all those, if you've read through all that information about how to write these reports, there is a great deal of emphasis on what's called the Engel chart. How are people responsive? And part of the factor, I think, that's part of the factor in deciding what kind of evangelist you send to. There are some people who could not function. There are some evangelists, depending on the country and the culture, who would create havoc. Think about a Zulu sent to evangelize the Afrikaner. I mean, boy. Or think of the problems vice versa.
That's probably more likely. But it makes headlines in the newspaper when a black man preaches in a white church.
And those are the sensitivities that you've got to struggle with in this question. So, for example, this, I think, is also important to Ralph's argument. The most effective evangelism, he says, is always E1. He does concede that point. The national leader always has a communication advantage over the foreigner. And in terms of anthropology, that's dead right. Culture change is always effectively made by insiders, not outsiders.
This ties in with the HUP.
Yeah, the HUP idea. And anthropologically, it's quite true. You read any of these books on culture change, and over again, they'll hit you with it. The change agents within a culture are never the outsiders. They're the insiders. So the most obvious surge forward, and this is Ralph's language, the most obvious surge forward in evangelism will come if Christian believers in every part of the world win their culturally near neighbors to Christ. And he admits that too. He doesn't, you see, he's not totally disregarding that 1 billion block there. I think what that means then also, I would underline this, there is no excuse for a foreign missionary, and I'm not thinking of a Western foreign missionary, but foreign missionary in the sense of E3, there's no sense for a foreign missionary as pastor in one pulpit when a national can do that job 400% better. And yet I see that pattern repeated all over the world. Missionaries go to countries and end up serving as pastors of one church. And I think totally refute this basic principle of structure. And this is, again, one of the great virtues of the Nevia system as it was developed in Korea, because the missionary, from the very start, did wide deputation. Don't stay in one church. But he kept moving around. So that the change, as it were, within the church had to come from the church, not from him. In a country where there is an established, vibrant church, E3 missionaries can be used elsewhere. And that's the point of the moratorium. Mm-hmm. And that's what Ralph argues for.
Mm-hmm. He argues for the moratorium.
Oh, yeah. Remember he talked about the euthanasia of the mission, mm-hmm. using the language of then. When you've got a church, you don't need E3 evangelists. Now, he doesn't mean, he says, you know, he made it very careful. You know, I'm not saying pull out all the support missionaries, you know, and he was very careful about that. But at the same time, what he was talking about was this whole question of evangelism and E3s. That's what controls his the whole pattern of his thinking.
Question yeah, here, sure. About, this has sort of been gnawing at me when Ralph Winter was given the statistics about missionaries in the world. He said the largest country was, or the second largest perhaps was Austria. And he said they have good scheme there. And,
and they have lots of missionaries.
Well, what if, this is sort of a real general question, but are the missionaries, I guess it's just like, us, isn't it? We just get comfortable and don't get out. But do missionaries abroad see these figures and statistics? And is this making a difference, or is this just sort of a North American introduction now? Or
boy, in one sense, it's hard to answer that, Mark. When I was in Taiwan this summer, I spoke at the Taiwan Missionary Conference. And that was a meeting of all the missionaries on the island.
Not Taiwanese.
Not Taiwanese. It's missionary fellowship. And so there are about there are about 300 about 300 missionaries who were there. And there's a total of about 600 there were as of 1976. Anyway, one of the messages was on looking for the hidden people in Taiwan. And I tried to bring out through Bible study what the Bible means by the lost. And, got a little different position there than Ralph does. But anyway, basically saying to or encouraging the missionaries, look for the there are all kinds of people around you that are responsive. Where are they? You know, how do you find them? Where would you find them? What would they be? And there was, I think, overall a very exciting response to the that kind of challenge. In the mornings, I spoke each morning. Then after the message, the missionaries all broke up into discussion groups. And I gave each discussion group each morning in connection with the talks about three or four questions that to let get the thing started. And I wished I could have been in all the group discussions, you know, because but I had, that day I had all kinds of people come back and say, oh, that was great, you know, really excited. And they had all kinds of lists of where they could go to find these hidden people. So I think my impression, Mark, just on Taiwan, is that when the challenge is uttered, is given, it strikes fire. That, I think, is I see as one of the great virtues of what Ralph is doing and these men are doing, is that they're forcing us to consider again the basic task of evangelism. And I think that's important. How Ralph said, remember Ralph said he was encouraged. He felt there was the beginning of changes in this direction.
Very good.
The EFMA, you know, had a whole week on hidden peoples. And he's going to speak on it at Urbana. He's going to lead he's going to lead the workshop on what is missions. So we should get lots of hidden people stuff at Urbana. But I think it takes time to filter down.
Yeah, it does.
I'm a member of a board. One board, and once a year we have a I'm the committee that plans a day-long discussion group for the board members, which I suspect also there aren't too many boards that do even that.
You mean of a mission board?
Yeah, and the board members, we all get together and I plan a whole day's discussion on any topic we want. So we've agreed, the board has agreed to my suggestion that at our next meeting we will discuss the unreached people and how to reach them in terms of the mission of this one board. So what I hope to do at the board meeting is I'll show the slides that we saw at the beginning of the course, and then I'll boil down everything we've been doing in this class to about 1 hour's presentation, and then open it up for discussion, any questions they have, so they can get the idea of what's going on here. But we'll try and hit them with a lot of statistics and just give them a picture of what needs to be done. Then after that, this board has a group called a committee called the New Fields Committee. They have laid before them now the possibilities of opening mission work in 4 or 5 countries to which they've never gone. So we'll ask the new Fields Committee to make a very brief presentation at that stage to the whole committee as to what the possibilities are. Then we're going to break up into three or four small group discussions and ask each group, on the basis of her hearing about the hidden peoples and the opportunities, to develop guidelines in their group as to where they would go and how they would reach the hidden people. And we'll come back for full discussion, and then that will be implemented in terms of policy. Now, I'm hoping that we'll see, you know, it could be a change. The board members are all going to have to read two pamphlets by Ralph, Penetrating the Last Frontiers and New Grounds for World Missions. So they'll get some of this stuff even before they come. And that way, when those kinds of things happen, you know, when you have it pumped into the boards at the administration level, that is very hopeful, which I think is the exciting thing, and I'm sure excites Ralph about being asked to do this at the EFMA. Though that will put together about 200 mission executives and who will hear this all week long. And then the hope is that this will then begin to filter into the board structures and to start changing directions. So there's real possibilities, I think. But it's still early, and it's just beginning now.
So, and who should reach the unreached? We should be saying 2 and 3 evangelists.
Yeah, it depends, of course, partly as we've said all along, it depends on how you're defining unreached, too, and hidden. That's why we've had to spend some time on that category. But let me go on then and just mention this a little bit in light, structure this with Ralph, because we're going to have to quit whatever we do today. All right, then, on this basis, why are missionaries needed at all? Isn't the church planted, as a matter of fact, on all 6 continents? And the answer is, yes, it is. And the answer is, no, it isn't. Ralph's answer is that where the cross-cultural task is the largest, the cross-cultural workers are the fewest. And this is where we need to look at this map. Three major blocks of people represent 2 million non-Christians in the world. Or to put it another way, it's on the side of the, you can see the side there of the map, 70% of all non-Christians come from 3 blocks. The Chinese, the Muslims, and the Hindus. That's why we're putting special attention on those when we go on from here. Now, the map is fairly, at least you see where the dotted line is on the right, and then you've got these 3 big circles to the right. Now, that's fairly to scale. Take a look at the Chinese circle. This is the largest racial and cultural block of humanity. Now, the large circle, you know, the darkly colored circle, represents those Chinese who do not consider themselves Christians. You notice inside the dark circle, there's a little circle, circle. Now, in the diagram, the white circle, the dotted circle, represents the 40 million overseas Chinese, the so-called Chinese of the diaspora, those who would be outside of the mainland.
Who are closely
close
to the
God. No, not necessarily. Who are geographically open. And similarly, the Hindu circle, you see, the bulk of Hindus would be found in India. But there is a significant number of Hindus who live outside the borders of India. Pakistan, Ceylon, large Hindu population in Indonesia, many Hindus in East Africa and in Southern Africa. So that's the significant of the little white circle within the dark ones, okay? Outside the larger circle, if you'll look and you'll see...
Thank you.
Yeah, you'll see tiny circles. Do you see them? Where are we here? Yeah. See the tiny circle here? And then another circle here? And no circle across from the muscles.
The inlet, between the two muscles.
No, that's a square, not a circle.
The square is tiny.
Right, I'll explain that in a minute. The point of the those little tiny circles, and if you look carefully, there is a circle inside the circle, right? Trust Ralph to give you complicated diagrams. The circle, the smaller circle, not the circle in the circle. Good gravy. The outer limits of the circle to the left represents those Chinese who consider themselves Christians. Okay? And the circle inside of it, those committed Christians on whom we may count to finish the job. Okay? Now, that's then why it's very significant when you look at the Muslim people. There is no circle. There is no church. And no, as it were, no visible body of believers drawn from Islam of a size that you could even put on a map. All right, what is, just in terms of China, what does that diagram say? Well, one, it talks about the vastness of the unfinished task among the Chinese, right? Just comparing those two circles. Also, the startlingly small amount of Chinese who may be reached now without going into the mainland. You know, it's not very big. Also, the even smaller number of Chinese committed Christians who can undertake the job. Look at that little dot, and that's what you've got to reach over 800 billion people. Now, in actual numbers, Ralph says it breaks down to this. We're thinking of Chinese. Total of 84 million Chinese. The 8,400,000,000 Chinese. And in that figure, of 84 million, 8 million who can be reached. Wait a minute. Yeah. Yeah, I'm 8 billion. 8,440,000,000. That's what it is. A total number of Chinese, right? Christians, non-Christians, one all together.
What you mean is 844 million.
That's what I said first. Maybe. You're sure confusing me. All
right.
Okay. 844 million. Makes sense. Okay. Better write this down. I will not pass this way again. All right, in that figure of 844 million, 803 million who can be reached only by E2 or E3 evangelism.
Say that
one more time. Okay. 840 million Chinese total. And of that, 803 million who can be reached only by E2 or E3 evangelists. Why? Look at the size of the church. Those Christians can only do, you see, E1 evangelism. So, reachable by ordinary E1 evangelism, according to Ralph, are only 38 million. Now, to reach those numbers, then Ralph calculates there are basically only 2 million consecrated Chinese Christians. Now, by actual 1977 count, the North American Protestant missionaries working among Chinese total 1,317. So what does that mean? Basically, E2 and E3 evangelists total roughly, let's say, 1,500. 1,500 to reach 800 million people. Now, the picture gets even more staggering when you consider the Muslims. 700 million Muslims in the world. And there, if you notice, there is no circle outside the larger circle, like we pointed out. By the way, those on the chart there, that's the significance of the square on the left. The square represents missionaries.
On a different scale.
That's drawn on a different scale. So you shouldn't think that there are more missionaries than there are Chinese Christians, but the scale is different. It's drawn only to indicate the proportionate number of missionaries to one another in these different groups. Now notice again the smallest square, working with the Muslims. The total missionary force from North America working among 700 million Muslims, this is by actual count in 1977, 136. So there are 136 Christians sent to do to evangelize 700 million people. Now, in summary, I'm just sort of summarizing Ralph's argument. I'd like to make maybe 3-4 points. I think this is a powerful argument, and this is somehow or other we've got to get this information over to the church. And just summarizing statistics. Number one, at least 4 out of 5 people in the largely unevangelized blocks of humanity do not have any near Christian neighbors. That breaks down to about 87%.
Of the world population.
Yeah. Number two, where there are Christian neighbors, local prejudices frequently can make E2 all but impossible. Example of this would be India. You know, you've got all these caste systems. You may have common languages. Let's say you both speak Malayalam, but you're a member of one caste, and your next door neighbor is a member of another. You will have great difficulties doing personal evangelism with your next door neighbor. If you're an untouchable, you can't enter his house, nor can you touch his clothes, nor can you put your lips to his cup. And the same problems, for example, we talked about this last week very practically in terms of who reaches the black Muslims. That must be E3. That may be effectively done probably only by E1. Right? That'd be by blacks.
Yes.
Because of the tremendous prejudices. And now it may be different, again, this is interesting, but you know that within the structure of Islam, of the black Muslims, there's been a change. So it'll be interesting to sort of sample that with Peter's context. Number three. So in other words, adding to an E3 outsider, somebody who does not share in the E2 prejudice system, he can often do more effective evangelism. Third point, for the gospel to reach all subcultures or HU units, it will be necessary for E2, for E3 evangelists to cross the cultural gap. To spark the development of the church in each culturally definable ethnos.
For E2 and E3.
Yeah. It's got to lie there. Number four, and this is the one that hurts. The average missionary today does not work directly among non-Christians. Most missionaries are located where there are by now many Christians. And most of them are working most of the time with the Christians rather than with the non-Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say 90% like winter?
Yeah, over.
More.
Now, why? I think there are a number of reasons for this. First of all, there is the successful development of the national church. There is the waning percentage of pioneer-type missionary recruits. There is increasing demand by the national church for the missionary specialist. For example, when I was in Korea this summer, the Korean church asked me to go back, and they would pay my salary, so I would go back under the Korean church. And they said, we would like you to set up an institute for foreign missions here, and for you to train armed foreign missionaries to go to other parts of the world.
To train Korean missionaries?
Yes, right, right. That's very intriguing.
Uh-huh.
My wife and I are wrestling about that now. But now, you know, I wasn't asked, will you come back and plant churches in Korea? I was asked to come back for a specialized job. Presumably when the job's done, I go home. Or maybe the church says, look, send us, we need specialists in urban church planting, in urban planning. Send us specialists in urban planning. Or we're involved in with the government. The government is now pushing some new big 5-year agricultural development plans. Send us an agricultural missionary who could work hand in hand with the government. So you have a very strong push towards specialized ministries. You read the International Job Opportunities book by Inger Christo, and you'll find over 3/4 of the job descriptions are specialist positions. Often what they called in the old days support, whatever. But it's very common kind of trend. I think another factor, which Ralph doesn't mention, is to this whole pattern, is also the so-called sending church does not specialize in pioneer evangelism. There are very few pastors, you know, who are doing evangelistic work. I'm a pastor, and so the pastors from whom you'll draw your missionaries, their whole career and ministry focuses on the believers here, right? Now, how are you going to teach them to do anything differently if you just slap a new label on them and call them missionary? You won't. If their focus here, salt water does not make an E3 evangelist. What makes an E3 is somebody who is willing to cross borders and call non-Christians to Christ. And you'll find very few of those in the United States or in sending churches in the West today. In Europe, for example, what are the believers, members we mentioned earlier? The vast bulk of men in Europe, you know, dedicated godly men, they're EO, right? Because they've got to work with a nominal church. That's their focus. So we send 5 missionaries from the church in Germany to go to work in Indonesia. What kind of people do you think they'll associate with? Well, they'll look for EOs, because that's the whole pattern of their lifestyle. That's they've grown up to do. That's what they expect to do there. And so often, another part of the problem is that we don't have the E3s to give people, because we have a church that doesn't create them. It's part of the problem, too, I think. The toughest job I think some of us have who are on foreign missions. I'm a member of one board where I serve on the candidates committee. And we've made some changes in our board, for example, and one of the areas in which candidates are queried very strongly is, have you done evangelistic work? And questions like, how many people have you brought to Christ? And what fruit have you seen from your evangelistic work in the United States? Because if they can't do it here, they will never do it there. But often those kinds of questions are not often asked, I suspect, of candidates. Yeah, but it's part of the pattern. So, for example, what happens then? Winter's guess is this. And I imagine when he said this, it must have jolted the brethren. Even the number of EFMA, IFMA missionaries, you know, evangelicals, you know, the safe, tried and true kind, Even the number of EFMA, IFMA missionaries working with non-Christian populations would be less than 1 out of 15. That would mean of all the number and the EFMA, IFMA missionaries are the largest force of missionaries in the world, broken down that way would be about 1,000. By contrast, the number of full-time Christian workers in the United States alone is now estimated at 30,000. 80 times as many. So what does this mean? Basically,
the evangelicals that are abroad,
yeah,
15% of them are working with non-Christians.
Yeah, only 15, okay. Right.
No, it's 1 in 15.
That
is a lot less than 15.
1 out of 15. One out of 15.
If it is one out of 10, it would be 10%.
Not 15%, one out of 15. Right.
Okay, I'm sorry.
So that'd be less than 10%, right? So, in other words, putting it this way, we in the United States have devoted to the task of reaching the unreached 1/80th of our evangelical full-time task force. And then Ralph says this, 97% of all the evangelizing energies of evangelicals around the world are being spent on renewing nominal Christians. 97% of all the evangelizing energy, you know, all the energy we could throw out into that job, are being spent and around the world, not just USA, are being spent on basically on the renewing of nominal Christians, EO work. Yet, nominal Christians are only a quarter as numerous as the total of nominal Christians and non-Christians. And that means basically, the nominal 25% are receiving 97% of all our attention. And that's what Ralph Winter and Pete Wagner and McGavran call the church development syndrome, where the whole force and attention of the church is on developing itself. What Juan Carlos Ortiz calls the church getting fat. Now, we could offer a lot of corrections and suggestions and comments. I've got several, but I think it's good enough to leave it right there.